today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an interview with Dr. James Catton, Chairman and CEO of the Institute for Global Futures. Dr. Catton is world-renowned as a futurist, international top-ranking thought leader, business strategist, author, speaker, and visionary. James, you bring a lifetime of proven top-ranking international thought leadership to our audience. Considering your heavy schedule, we thank you for doing this interview with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
You know, James, trends are mission critical to all sectors, and you have a trend tracker service which promises to provide ready access to key trends worldwide. How did this all start, and can you provide a short history of the Institute for Global Futures and your role with it?
Well, I was a government advisor in the 70s as a young man, and working as a domestic and international policy advisor, it became clear to me that the way we thought about the future was very incomplete. And then later on, I joined Apple Computer and worked on the introduction of the Macintosh computer. And even then, I realized that technology was such a change driver in terms of innovation, but still our way of forecasting the future seemed to be, again, incomplete. So I became very interested in helping my clients understand what was coming in the future. And the reason I founded the Institute for Global Futures in 1990, after I had been an investment banker and I had been a serial entrepreneur, mostly in the high-tech area, after I left Apple in 84, was because my clients said to me, you know, we need to know what's coming next. And my clients were global Fortune 1000 clients, big multinationals, and, of course, governments. And the tool set to be able to forecast what was coming seemed to be not very effective. So over the past, really, 25 years, I've developed tools to better understand and get some glimpse of what possible futures may be, but also to extract information so I can come up with strategies to help companies and governments think differently about the future. So I'm really in the business of forecasting the future and coming up with these tools because the future is becoming more complex to navigate, becoming more faster in terms of accelerated changes, and the crises and challenges that face us all are coming closer to us. So we need to get better at anticipating these challenges, these risks, so that we can turn them into opportunities. So simply put, I'm in business as a author and futurist and advisor because my clients need to understand what's coming next.
So for IGF, this Institute for Global Futures, what do you hope to achieve in the next 5 years?
Well, pretty much what we're achieving now. We advise a number of governments and leading multinationals worldwide and on the future convergence of key trends. So, you know, I've written a new book, The Extreme Future. Over the next 5 years, I'm sure I'll write another book. I'll give another probably 500 keynote presentations and executive briefings to government leaders, CEOs, and presidents around the world. You know, our job at the IGF is to be able to help people plan better and think about the future so we can prepare for the next 100 cities, mega cities in the world, so we can prepare for changes in climate, so we can prepare for demographic shifts, so we can prepare for advanced, accelerated, intelligent technologies that are going to emerge. So what we hope to achieve over the next 5 years is to be of service to help leaders architect a future that will be perhaps more productive, more peaceful, and certainly more profitable.
Are there some recent wins that illustrate the kind of services and benefits your company offers?
Well, we've worked with major companies such as GE, who, in terms of their interest in green and eco imagination. We work with major companies like GE to help them understand the impact of climate change. of course, we've advised companies like IBM, Fujitsu, other companies that are very interested in the leading edge of telecommunications. I'm been an advisor to Motorola to help them understand the future of pervasive mobility, and that translates into certain kinds of new phones and devices. When it comes to the Internet, of course, we're looking, while others are looking at Web 2.0, we're looking at Web 3.0, pervasive, immersive Internet with rich media. And we're spending a lot of time, I would say, focusing also on the convergence of four key technologies, nano, neuro, IT networks. We're looking at the next generation of neurological computer systems, and we're focusing a lot on ventures. We're advising a number of governments and working with our corporate clients in emerging markets, such as certainly in Asia. We do a fair amount of work with the government of Singapore, and of course we are working on ventures inside of China in the pharmaceutical area and biotech area. The key markets that we're looking, future markets that will emerge, we're looking at, for instance, the health and human enhancement marketplace. It's going to be the largest marketplace of the 21st century, larger than even defense. As people live longer, they're going to need more and more devices and pharmaceuticals to enhance the quality of their life. So that is one of the key markets that we're now working with, particularly in Asia.
You know, you've made many predictions well in advance of the marketplace. Can you comment on the ones that stand out in your mind?
Well, the key ones were, and again, I have to say that my forecasts often have been because I have an unfair advantage. When you advise the largest innovation and technology labs in the world, you have a tendency of being able to see things first. In fact, being able to be part of the group that recommends what to even spend billions of dollars on. So I view that as an unfair advantage, but one that I'm delighted to have. The forecast that I've made, particularly about, I'll give you a couple of them early on, the forecast about certainly the impact of pervasive computers and networks in our world. I made those forecasts early in the 80s and 90s. And then in the 90s, I talked about something called the Internet. Again, I had an unfair advantage because I had an Internet account in the 70s through an academic institution. So I saw where the Internet, and this is before the web was going, very early on, I forecasted that the Internet was going to be a major transaction environment that was going to change retail, change the evolution of supply chains, change the way people even thought about information exchange. So early on, I stuck my neck out about the Internet and computing at a time when many people didn't see why would you need to use computers or wireless networks in hospitals, for instance, or for what could it do for healthcare. So early on, when it came to transformation of, which is still becoming today, healthcare, retail, online retail, of course, online financial services, very early on, I forecasted the Internet. I was also the first futurist to forecast the impact of nanotechnology, the manipulation of matter at the atomic level. I was the first private sector advisor to the U.S. government or any government in the area of nanoscience, nanoengineering. So that, again, is a trend that's just beginning. I forecasted that over almost 15 years ago. The impact of nanotechnology would be very fundamental to the way we make products, where we make materials, and even how we integrate nanobio into pharmaceutical. Third area, of course, was biotech, the post-genomic society. My forecasts about being able to use biomimetics, being able to use nature as a platform and the combination of nano and bio to create new kinds of pharmaceuticals, some of which we would grow with plants. I mean, I'm involved with a company called iCor, for instance, that uses a extracted protein to help people to create pharmaceuticals for anemia, right? It's got an organic biological protein as the core of it. So these are some of the forecasts that I've made that I think in the past have played out and become multi-billion dollar areas. Again, clean tech is just beginning, though. I forecasted that over a decade ago when most of my clients were not interested. But then I have a long history of being able to stand up to my clients and saying, you need to pay attention to this, whether it's clean tech or whether it's the Internet or nano. And, of course, I've had the privilege of being right about many of those, and I've been able to put my clients into very profitable opportunities, and I would expect to do so in the future.
Particularly in Asia, how can your research insights deliver benefits to those various sectors? Let's say, for example, in China.
Well, in China, and again, I've been going to China for many years, and I have a number of businesses there. I advise there, and I write certainly books about China, and I keep an ongoing dialogue in China. I go to China probably every 3 to 6 months on business. China is very fascinating to me. My forecast there about the future of cities, China will have over the next couple of decades, certainly alone, over 100 new megacities will be born there. China's embracing of the of innovation and advanced innovation is very smart because it will really help to offset how you manage today 1.3 billion, but how you provide for 2 billion people in terms of productive, healthy quality of life, being able to provide habitats, provide jobs. So my forecast there and my work there, I view is very important because it's the convergence of what's next for demographics and population change. Of course, China's struggling with issues regarding certainly how they deal with their own climate change and the impact of being able to head off the next trends regarding pollution there, and of course productivity. And interestingly, at the core of all of this is IT. The next generation of cities that will emerge will need a very complex AI, artificial intelligence, and IT to manage them. And I think the next generation of quality of life and productivity will be driven by many innovations that maybe we will not even be embracing in the West, but they may show up first and even be invented by some of our Chinese innovators. So I'm keeping an eye closely on China, and I'm also forecasting what's happening there.
Can you share your thoughts on the top trends in the extreme future? And I know that's sort of a focal point for you, and how they will shape business and society?
Well, sure, certainly. That's the subject of my book that's just come out. I think it's being translated as we speak into Mandarin. The top trends that I talk about in my book certainly are, one is called Fueling the Future. It's all about the next fuels, such as hydrogen, solar, geothermal, but also how we're going to deal with a world of more expensive and certainly less oil, and the impact of a post-oil future on global and regional economies. I talk about the innovation economy, which is the transformation of the global economy based on convergence of free trade, technology, and certainly how it's going to affect new markets, globalization, and competition. Probably the investment in innovation, both of individuals, of countries, and companies, is the most important trend that I talk about. Innovation will grow GDP, will grow profits, and will grow personal wealth, which I think is a very important trend in the extreme future. The third trend is the next workforce, how the workforce worldwide will become more multicultural, certainly more global, and what I call the two worlds challenge, how we will bring together the emerging economies with the emerged economies, the West and the East, how we will collaborate to create a world that is both productive and peaceful. I talk about that. Perhaps number four is longevity medicine, how people will be living longer. And again, more importantly, perhaps since I am really a business futurist, there's a lot of different forecasts you can make, but certainly people living longer will require a lot more services, a lot more assistance, but also a different kind of lifestyle. I think longevity medicine, this combination of nanobio and neurotechnologies that will refresh the aging mind, refresh and rebuild part of our bodies in terms of cybernetics. This is where we're headed towards. This is a very important trend. In the weird science, I talk about how future science will transform every aspect of our lives, from teleportation to nanobiology, to even thinking about and being able to unify, resolve the key issues in physics between Einstein's universe and, of course, the new emerging worlds of what happens at the quantum level. So is it possible to be able to communicate with multiple universes, since multiple universe theory is currently being debated now? I think it's very interesting. Number six is securing the future. Many threats to our world of peace and productivity, being able to, particularly in places like China, maintain strong growth, are going to be based on security. And a new narrative that needs to emerge where those that are interested in free markets and open markets and certainly capitalism can work together to create more security. Number seven is the future of globalization, cultures and collision. We need to work towards a world where there's more of an even playing field to be able to bring up those economies that are not as strong, to be able to make more global trade and competition, be able to remove the clashes of cultures. And I talk about particularly what's needed to move global GDP beyond about 7%, move it north to about 10%. Of course, certainly innovation is important. And then my last couple of trends are on the future of climate change. I talk about specifically clean tech, the increased global warming, pollution, threats to health in the future if we do not change. And I make recommendations on creating the next eco cities and eco policies that nations and corporations should embrace, everything from investment banks on. Finally, I talk about the future of the individual and the importance of individuals learning to navigate ideologies, governments, technology, and, you know, the struggle for individuals to be able to embrace their opportunities for innovation and growth and developing their potential in the 21st century, and the opportunities for, if you will, freedom and liberty and open markets so individuals can be prosperous. And finally, our 10th trend is the future of America and certainly China. I talk about that rich, intimate collaboration that will be needed to balance the world in terms of peace, prosperity, and opportunity in the 21st century.
Do you have some additional comments on these extreme future trends and how they will specifically play out in China? Like, what are some of the actual opportunities that would be enabled both within China and globally?
Well, one of the key, let's just assume and run out for a moment and assume that China is going to be, is going to increase for every year for the next 10 years a minimum of 20% to 30% growth in terms of manufacturing. So China will be increasingly the leading manufacturer for all products in the world. If we make that assumption, the key challenge that China needs to embrace in order to do that is regulatory quality control. Quality control this is a very important historic moment for China to embrace quality control, whether it's for using the safe materials based on European and American standards, whether it's for being able to follow through with the right quality control and safety for pharmaceuticals. This is very important because the future of China in terms of manufacturing is to then move up the value chain and manufacture higher value knowledge products. Now, these knowledge products may be high-end medical devices more so than today. They may be more complicated, specific kinds of pharmaceuticals. They may be certain kinds of industrial products that have to do with the next generation of energy, let's say, or industrial production or computing and networking. The only way for China to be able to move up the value chain is to be able to pay attention to their quality assurance and quality control and even surpass the standards that have been set in the U.S. and Europe. I think this is very vital. The second area is when it comes to life sciences, China has a historic opportunity to not just be the place where people do trials or even do development, but the whole area of research and research on entirely new kinds of pharmaceuticals that can then be rapidly brought to market. I think that could make a very important contribution to the world, not just to China. So the other areas that relate to China are, I think, being able to bring pervasive wireless internet. I mean, you should be able to bring the internet to every corner of China, and that would create a massive marketplace even within regions of China, but also start to deal with one of the key challenges that China has, which is to bridge the gap between the rural, poorer parts of China, which still are not even in the 20th century, but need to be brought on board to create more opportunity, and the cities where there's a lot more wealth. Speaking at another level, I'm concerned about the wealth factor between the haves and have-nots, the rich and the poor. That gap is growing very fast, and I think that's another area that China needs to be very careful about and plan so there is more of an even playing field in terms of economic opportunity. And I think, again, technology will play a critical role. And again, whether it's the next 100 or 200 cities, I mean, China has an historic opportunity to be able to bring better part of three-quarters of a billion people into the 21st century over the next 2 to 3 decades. That's a very big challenge. The only way to do that is to think boldly in terms of global planning, is to think boldly in terms of innovation and prosperity, and particularly education. There's two other areas that are very important for China to be able to meet future successfully. One is education. I mean, Peking University has over 1 million applications a year for college. There's no way that, again, China needs to expand its educational opportunities so that getting into college is not something that is, one, expensive or is just for the elite. It must be for a large mass of the population to be able to look towards going to advanced studies in university. So that the investment, China's investment in its education infrastructure will be very critical. China's investment in their IT infrastructure to bring the internet as a global platform for whether it's managing cities or education is going to be very critical. China's investment in its infrastructure for technology and healthcare, for instance, is going to be very critical to be able to meet the needs of a couple of billion people over the next number of decades. I think in the last area is very important is China's opportunity to be able to create more, if you will, address the issues of pollution before health crises impact will be very important as well. So again, the massification of an infrastructure that will provide more quality of life will become mission critical and will shape the future social stability and outcome of the Chinese for the next 100 years.
Now, what do you see as the top opportunities and innovations in IT, and how can they be exploited for a competitive advantage?
Well, certainly there's four key technology buckets that will drive this. One is what is going to happen to the global services economy. Global services economy are everything from workflow process to records management to, you know, all the different kinds of services that, for all intents and purposes, China has not really played as much in that game as India has. And I think China could learn a lot from India in terms of creating, again, the reason that India is able to achieve a certain degree of expertise in IT services is because of their investments, their deep investments in the education system to be able to do so, and secondarily, their traction, their ability to be able to have a stable environment but also to make it attractive for other global multinationals to come there to do so. So I think that's going to be part of it for IT. The other is there are going to be, this is, you know, the notion of tiered IT services, meaning if I could, for instance, get access to a supercomputer, Array, to do complex research, and China could become the, have a supercomputer infrastructure that I could buy on demand expertise, both raw computing power, data centers and services, but also the expertise. I call them knowledge engineers. So I bring a specific problem, whether it's about physics or it's about production of a new product or a pharmaceutical or about dealing in space, you know, some kind of an advanced, complex problem that China's IT infrastructure then could be able to bring the manpower, this knowledge, these knowledge engineers, and this raw networking and computer power to bear, then you could have higher-level services and products could come out of that kind of interplay. That's part of it. The other is the media and entertainment area. I mean, I would imagine over the next 25 years that China might have the ability to be able to host massively parallel game environments, immersive media. Part of the future of IT is certainly what are the key markets that this powerful, pervasive IT infrastructure is going to support. And clearly it's going to be things such as healthcare, certainly on-demand healthcare in a post-genomic world where I can have instantaneous, I can put my thumbprint up to the computer in San Francisco, and there's going to be a bioinformatics team in Shanghai that's able to scan my thumbprint and get my DNA and give me a real-time update on my my DNA for being able to create a personal health profile. I mean, this is going to be, you're talking about a massive new marketplace that has not even developed yet to be able to expand. So I view this as part and parcel with this, just part and parcel with this. That's one big area. Imagine also that the IT infrastructure in China could be serving a global marketplace of 4 billion people that want to be playing massively parallel immersive games where they put on a headset and go into a virtual reality and play. You have to host that someplace. You have to serve that someplace, and you've got to be able to manage very multiply high-scale data services. That infrastructure may be, again, best served being placed in China. So those are two vertical areas, certainly healthcare, certainly media entertainment. A third area certainly is the ability to be able to create manufactured products on demand, where you can create elegant supply chains that are, again, on one end they do advanced CAD designs, on the other hand you have the supply chain, there's prototype development, and the third side there's research, and the fourth side of it is factories that will produce these products very cost-effectively for mass audiences. Again, this IT infrastructure that will transform global supply chains would be hosted certainly in China. And finally, another kind of future of IT for in terms of a role for China to play could certainly be, we talked a little bit about healthcare, media entertainment, supply chains. Perhaps the last area could be in, there are going to be huge global fixes such as geoengineering, space exploration, new big challenges that, again, you're going to need tremendous computing and networking power and the expertise to invent and manage these systems, whether it's about landing or exploring space or about geoengineering the planet or terraforming other planets in the future. And again, China could play a role in those areas as well. And each of these are tremendous business opportunities as well.
What do you see as the top risks for businesses, and how can they be resolved?
The big risk for businesses is not thinking about the future. Most businesses are focused on the now. They're focused on the next quarter. They don't have a long view. They don't have what I call a strategic view. You need to have a strategic view in your business, whether you're the head of a multi-billion dollar company or whether you're a startup, right? It's the same challenge. It's thinking about having the capacity to be what I call future ready. Most of our business mindsets are based on the short term. I'm writing a new book about the mindsets of leaders, right? I call it the innovator's mindset. You need to be thinking about what's coming. You need to have more of a strategic view. So there's a great risk in not thinking, or what I call being future ready. If you do not think about what's coming next and have a capacity built into your organization to be looking for what's coming next, what's next for the customer? What's next for customers you don't have today you'd like to have tomorrow? What's next for your particular area, whether it's in healthcare or entertainment or defense or energy? You know, what's next? What are the key innovations that are going to be emerging are going to play the dominant role. And if you don't invest in them or know what they are or are collaborating with others that are doing them, that is going to be the chief risk. And that is all about mindset. And again, because if you have a mindset that thinks about the future, then you'll collaborate today. If you have a mindset that thinks about what's coming in the future, then you'll start to discover and look around and maybe even invent situations or new products and services that have not been thought of today. I mean, my forecast is 90% of all products and services the companies will be selling in 5 years have not been invented yet, which means there's a whole lot of room for new innovation. So one risk is not, in summary, is not thinking long-term enough strategically. The second risk is not creating a culture that is innovative or looking for innovations and investing in those innovations. And a third risk is thinking too small. People need to think big about this marketplace. And the fourth, perhaps, is the global marketplace, the explosion of globalization, the advantage of globalization has not happened yet. This is still very early in the game. So think globally about where your markets are. And then perhaps the fifth and final one is that innovations, whether it's nano, bio, neuro, IT, new innovations are coming very fast. And these will be disruptive for those that are not ready to change fast enough or embrace them, but pay attention to emerging innovations because they will be the key drivers of either risk or opportunity.
You know, what forecasts are you making along these fronts? For example, in the demographics area, the social area, and economic area. And then from there, what would be the implications of these forecasts to different stakeholders?
Let me give you an example. For instance, the largest concentration of wealth in the world is in aging baby boomers' bank accounts right now. What we have found in our surveys, and we do a lot of surveys worldwide, and we analyze research in over 200 countries. We use that and fold that into our trend tracker engine, right? We have an analytics engine that we have developed. Our trend tracker is an analytics-based engine that we use. We call it the prediction engine, and we use that to be able to make these larger forecasts. One of the key things we discovered in that is with the better part of over 100 million people that are controlling the better part of $20 trillion worth of wealth. That's U.S. dollars, okay? And most of them, 90%, 98% almost, are elderly, okay? Aging boomers, which is somewhere between, let's say, 50 and 65 years old, all right? Now, worldwide, what aging boomers want, as well as Generation X right before them, but let me just say broad-based demographics show that people want to invest more of their wealth and their earning power into living longer and being healthier, okay? This demographic reality of now, let's say, we have not just 100 million, but in the next not even decade, we'll have the better part of a, perhaps as many as a billion people that have declared that human and health enhancement is important to them. They will be living longer as we improve public health. We improve life expectancy, particularly in Asia, Africa, other places of the world where we're making tremendous inroads in public health. So you've got now a billion people that would like to live an extra even 10 to 15 years longer and will be because of prosperity and productivity, increased GDP, increased globalization. And you're now talking about a business opportunity that, quite frankly, didn't exist even 10 or 15 years ago. You're talking about new kinds of pharmaceuticals, new kinds of materials, new kinds of devices to maintain people's health and well-being and to be able to give them the ability to live longer. So here is where demographics, certainly a large cohort of the population worldwide, right, the better part of a couple hundred million people, today over 100 million today, oh, certainly within the next 10 years, another 100 million people, are this is where demographics converges with wealth, meaning that the same population of a couple hundred million people within this decade will be in control, the better part of as much as $15 to $20 trillion worth of spendable and liquid assets. So you have demographics colliding with wealth that now gives people a consensual objective, which is to live longer and healthier. Now, who's listening to all that? All the major biotech, pharmaceutical companies, healthcare companies. I mean, we're heading towards an era where this massive economics converges with demographics will create a new marketplace called health and human enhancement. It doesn't exist unless you have the convergence of more than one or two areas together that make for a trend. You see where I'm going? It's for me to say the health and human enhancement trend, the reason we got to that forecast with our prediction engine was because we saw a large number of people, or the better part of 100 million people who were investing in their wealth into living longer and healthier, and that became a value for them. That's what creates a trend. Economics plus demographics plus innovation together make for a trend. So we look at a number of these trends. That's one very obvious one. You can see the Internet as an example of that. I mean, the online transactions on the Internet for all transactions across all markets worldwide has increased the better part of almost 300% over the past 3 or 4 years. It will continue to grow dramatically. I mean, even in my own life, I live in San Francisco, I travel the world, but recently I wanted to buy some new art for my home. Well, quite frankly, I found on eBay, I found a number of Chinese painters who were living somewhere in the Canton province and were painting beautiful impressionist paintings, oil paintings. And it was a very reasonable price. I bought them on eBay. They were delivered. Now they're sitting in my living room next to painters from Europe and the United States. These people are not known any place in the world, but their art is beautiful. I am now a global consumer. I'm now being able to fuel a marketplace based on quality and based on, if you look at Web 2.0, I'm now a market of, I found a very select niche market through the Internet to be able to engage in commerce. I'm forecasting that today we've got about a billion people on the Internet who are buying and selling. My forecast is within 10 years, you'll have over 2 billion people on the Internet buying and selling, and this will be a very vital transaction environment for the future.
I guess tied in with that would be the, well, some people are calling the millennials or Gen Y, those born post-1980, and their attitudes are different. What is your research indicating about that group?
Well, it's very interesting. The millennials, I have kids who are millennials. You know, they're a very different set of values. I just want to point out that, you know, the millennials though they tend to be more narcissistic, meaning they're more focused on themselves, they tend to be less loyal, meaning they may have multiple careers. Remember, they will be living longer. So the boomers today, investment in health and human enhancement may cost them a dollar. The generation right behind them, the Generation X, that same investment due to Moore's Law will cost them a quarter, right? Let's say the quarter, 25% of that. And then, of course, the millennials will cost them probably less than a penny for that same enhancement, right? So interestingly, the millennials will be living longer than and healthier than any other population, but I think that there are some potential risk factors with that particular demographic group, particularly in Asia. In fact, there's some very good research study that we looked at, specifically we analyzed, and we used it in our prediction engine, our analytics engine, Trend Tracker, and what we found was that Asia is headed towards, particularly China, is headed towards a potential crisis because you have a number of, there's a correlation between as Chinese become more affluent, meaning this new affluence that's emerging, right, they tend to have smaller families. By the way, it's not just true in China, but it's true throughout the world. Increased affluence in a population, particularly in a knowledge-based population, not agricultural. I mean, agricultural-based population, you need big families to be able to work in the fields and work in agriculture and take care of everybody, right? And oftentimes, because of war or poor health care, you may lose a number of the family members, right? But in increased advanced emerging societies that are knowledge-based, where you have quality health care, you have more peace, security, less war, you tend to have smaller families. Of course, look at Europe. You see the example. We call it depopulation. The problem with Europe is they are desperately trying to increase immigration because they're not making enough of their own kind, and they need to bring in more folks from the rest of the world. Certainly, immigration has been a ticket to productivity advances in the United States as well. In China, you don't have that issue, but you have the beginnings of that same problem. You know, the double-edged sword of affluence and prosperity is smaller families. Now, that may, for the next 100 years, not be a problem in China because of, the one-child and post-one-child policy, but eventually you may have depopulation issues in certain regions or cities in China that will have to be dealt with. Meaning, will China have the skilled, educated population to move up the value chain in terms of providing advanced products and services to maintain social stability? Keep in mind, China needs to maintain about 7% GDP, a minimum of 7% GDP, to maintain social cohesion, social stability, and economic growth. North of that, which is what it is today, it's closer to 14% GDP, is even better, but it can't go below 7%, or there would be, I think, social problems that the Chinese, nor does anybody else in the world, want to see happening in China. China's moving along very nicely.
Are there particular business and technology leadership areas in China that we need to watch within the next 5 or 10 years, and that will have some kind of global impact?
Yes, I think the areas that China could achieve excellence in and make be very productive would be in the areas certainly of robotics and mobile autonomous robotics for manufacturing could play a very important role. You know, what's the next generation of manufacturing facilities look like in the world? When you think of next generation of manufacturing being dominated by robotics, nanotechnology, nanoscience, certainly the combination of advanced global supply chains. So I think that's one area, certainly is the next generation of manufacturing. The second is there are certain vertical industries that China could excel in. This area of advanced global services for healthcare or for manufacturing or for, you know, being able to provide the services that people will need, particularly in the area of financial transactions. I think this is going to be very important. You're going to need a very big infrastructure support for that. I think a third area is certainly peace management and security. I think this is going to be a very large area for China, both internally and externally. Market, and of course, all of these three areas I've talked about, you're going to need a very smart, a very elegant, a very on-demand global infrastructure to maintain, as well as, you know, millions of people. The third area, of course, is this whole area of health and human enhancement, but certainly biopharmaceuticals, medical devices, again, cybernetics, where you have advanced hips, arms, legs, being able to rebuild humans. But also, let me just say, the post-genomic work and proteomic work, this whole area of systems biology, you know, we're just beginning to map and understand the human genome. Next generation of genomic drugs that will create the next generation of humans. This is how profound this is. Will be, again, those services may come first from China. And I think that is a tremendous opportunity for China to play a role in the future of life sciences at its core level, which has to do with the enhancement, the health enhancement and human enhancement of what people may be in terms of reaching their full potential. In other words, we could potentially eliminate many diseases. We could potentially, through genetic enhancement and genetic drugs, be able to create the next generation of individuals free from not just diseases but other kinds of genetic problems. So much of what we know about disease over the next 25 to 50 years will be transformed. China could play a primary role in research and development. You think about the number of scientists, the number of entrepreneurs, number of researchers, the number of engineers that could come out of China, and I think this could lead a revolution, certainly in medicine, could emerge from China playing a very important role in this as well.
You know, James, you've had this long history of success, and it's acknowledged worldwide. Are you able to distill from this considerable history of global research and all the things that you accomplished some key lessons?
Well, for whom? For governments or for individuals or for corporations?
Everybody. Just for everybody.
Well, some of the key lessons I've learned are, one is, as I've said many times to my clients, develop a capacity to think strategically about the long term. That long term may be 3 to 5 years. It may be as long as 10 to 15 or 20 years. That's number one. The second is pay attention to lifestyle, because consumers' lifestyles will tell us a lot about what we need to do, whether we're a corporation or whether we're an entrepreneur or whether we're a government official, how we can best serve the individual and the consumer. Okay? Lifestyles will tell us a lot. The third is the future is coming much faster. We map the human genome much faster than we thought. The Internet's ability to create business opportunity created, you know, happened much faster. Certainly, the emergence of more mobile, smarter robots is happening very fast. In other words, the innovation is a key driver of opportunity. So pay attention to it and invest in it, or you will suffer from others competing. The fourth lesson rather is about collaboration. Ultimately, it is in the interest of many stakeholders, whether, you know, if you're Chinese, you obviously, a big part of China's present and China's future has to do with the sustainability and health of the U.S. economy and the European economy. So, you know, we are all in this together now. It's an entirely new conversation about collaboration of markets, collaboration of work, collaboration of talent, collaboration of education. there is nobody that's doing going alone. So the whole era of competition has to be rethought because our economies now are linked. If the U.S. stock markets have a bad day, what happens is that it has implications in China, Korea, in Europe, and vice versa. So we are linked. This is a global linkage of a markets and economy. We need to think more collaboratively about how we together bring more prosperity to those who are between the haves and have-nots. We need to pay attention to leveling the playing field. And then lastly, I would say people need to be more positive about the future. They need to be more open to change, but also recognize that the future is coming very fast, but also we need to maintain an openness about it so we can understand differences in culture, but also we can approach things together with a more positive, optimistic attitude rather than one that is fearful of the future, because there will be challenges. There are risks. Climate change is a risk. More expensive energy is a risk. Terrorism is a risk. Social instability is a risk. And we need to work together in order for the community, the global community needs to work together, and only from working together will we be effectively be able to meet the challenges of the 21st century for all peoples on the planet.
James, are there any additional comments you'd like to make at the close of this interview?
Well, no. If people want more information, certainly they can go to our website, futureguru.com, or they can check out what we're doing, and we're always open to people's feedback as such.
You know, James, we will continue to follow your significant contributions to the world through your writings, keynotes, research presentations, and frequent media appearances. For example, you're on CNN and various other major outlets, and we thank you for sharing your time, wisdom, and all of these accumulated insights with our audience.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been an honor.